Good morning, everyone. This morning, our first reading comes from the book of Isaiah, and we're looking at chapter 25. We're going to be reading verses 6 to 9. So Isaiah 25, verses 6 to 9. On this mountain, the Lord Almighty will prepare a feast of rich food for all peoples, a banquet of aged wine, the best of meats and the finest of wines. On this mountain he will destroy the shroud that enfolds all peoples, the sheet that covers all nations. He will swallow up death forever. The sovereign Lord will wipe away the tears from all faces. He will remove his people's disgrace from all the earth. The Lord has spoken. In that day they will say, "Surely this is our God. We trusted in him and he saved us. This is the Lord, we trusted in him. Let us rejoice and be glad in his salvation." And our second reading this morning comes from the book of Mark as we continue on in our series. We're going to read chapter 2, from verse 13 through to chapter 3, verse 6. So we continue to hear a bit about what Jesus has been saying and doing that have raised some eyebrows. So starting at Mark chapter 2, verse 13. Once again, Jesus went out beside the lake. A large crowd came to him, and he began to teach them. As he walked along, he saw Levi, son of Alphaeus, sitting at the tax collector's booth. "Follow me," Jesus told him, and Levi got up and followed him. While Jesus was having dinner at Levi's house, many tax collectors and sinners were eating with him and his disciples, for there were many who followed him. When the teachers of the law, who were Pharisees, saw him eating with the sinners and tax collectors, they asked his disciples, "Why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners?" On hearing this, Jesus said to them, "It is not to the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. I have not come to call the righteous, but the sinners." Now John's disciples and the Pharisees were fasting. Some people came and asked Jesus, "How is it that John's disciples and the disciples of the Pharisees are fasting, but yours are not?" Jesus answered, "How can the guests of the bridegroom feast while he is with them? They cannot, so long as they have him with them. But the time will come when the bridegroom will be taken from them, and on that day they will fast. No one sews a patch of unshrunk cloth onto an old garment. Otherwise, the new piece will pull away from the old, making the tear worse. And no one pours new wine into old wineskins. Otherwise, the wine will burst the skins, and both the wine and the wineskins will be ruined. No, they pour new wine into new wineskins." One Sabbath, Jesus was going through the grain fields, and as his disciples walked along, they began to pick some heads of grain. The Pharisees said to him, "Look, why are they doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath?" He answered, "Have you never read what David did when he and his companions were hungry and in need? In the days of Abiathar the high priest, he entered the house of God and ate the consecrated bread, which is lawful only for priests to eat. And he also gave some to his companions." Then he said to them, "The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. So the Son of Man is Lord, even of the Sabbath." Another time Jesus went into the synagogue, and a man with a shriveled hand was there. Some of them were looking for a reason to accuse Jesus, so they watched him closely to see if he would heal him on the Sabbath. Jesus said to the man with the shriveled hand, "Stand up in front of everyone." Then Jesus asked them, "Which is lawful on the Sabbath, to do good or to do evil, to save life or to kill?" But they remained silent. He looked around at them in anger, and deeply distressed at their stubborn hearts, he said to them, "Stretch out your hand." He stretched it out, and his hand was completely restored. Then the Pharisees went out and began to plot with the Herodians how they might kill Jesus.
About 12 years ago, I was in Melbourne. That's where I used to live. And I was attending this course. I was training up to be in broadcast television. And there was one guy there, a colleague of mine, who he says to me, for some reason, I'm not really sure why he went there, but he goes, "Are you religious?" And in my head, I'm thinking, well, I wouldn't really consider myself religious. So I flicked it back to him and I said, "Well, what do you mean?" He goes, "Well, like a, you know, like a Christian." And again, in my head, the connections I'm making, I'm going, well, I don't really consider myself to be a Christian in the sense of a religious Christian, so I don't really want to say that. So again, I kicked it back to him and I said, "Well, what do you mean when you say Christian?" And he replies with, "Someone who is good, you know, someone that's pretty good and does lots of good things." And at that point, I realized that just by saying I'm a Christian can actually have a fair bit of ambiguity about it, and it can end up being quite a fuzzy term. To just say I'm a Christian and leave that hanging, it's open to whatever the other person thinks a Christian is that they'll run with. So I've been a little bit sort of nervous and reticent to immediately give myself the label Christian in our culture and our society without having a context in which to explain what I mean by Christian. Because people may take their cue from all sorts of things. They may have, say, one friend of mine, he went to a Catholic school, and as part of what they had to do as students there, they had to go into the confessional once a week and confess their sins. So this was part of what they did at a Catholic school. And he says that he ended up walking away from Christianity because he was going into the confessional and he's thinking, I don't know what on earth I could confess. So he started to make things up. He is in the confessional making up things in order to do this thing that apparently makes you a Christian in the confessional. So he got really pretty twisted and warped by that, because when he could reflect on it later, he's thinking, well, how messed up is that? You're going into a confessional and you make up lies in order to do the thing. And so he walked away from Christianity as a result of that. Or there may be people who, you know, they have grown up in some sort of religious environment and they've had really strict parents, or maybe you often hear some pastors' kids often walk away from Christianity because they see it as, it's all about rules, you know, you can't touch alcohol. A Christian cannot hold hands with a girl before they're married, lest they accidentally have a baby somewhere in there. Seriously, someone said that to me once. And, you know, and they, or you can't listen to rock music because that's opening up a doorway for the devil to enter you. These are some of the ideas and experiences people have had with the label Christian, and it makes it confusing for them. Or maybe they don't have any sort of environment of formal Christianity that they've been in, but they've seen other people, and they've seen people on the street corner saying turn or burn, and that's what they associate with Christianity. Or they flick on the TV and A Current Affair and Today Tonight are doing an expose on Hillsong, which they seem to pull out every, 3 months, pretty much. And they spend most of their time focusing on how Brian Houston from Hillsong has a gold Rolex watch. And that's the cue people are left with. Oh, is that what Christianity is about? Or maybe they do know an authentic Christian, a real Christian, but they go, wow, I look at that and they live a good life and there's no way that I could be that kind of person. I can't do that. I can't get to that level. And so they walk away. Do you see what I mean by the term Christian in this day and age? By just having it out there, people come from it from all different angles and they can mean something by it that you might not mean. So it's pretty fuzzy. It's pretty confusing. A lot of people have hijacked the term and they use it for whatever they want to promote. So we need to be very clear on what we mean when we use the term Christian. And although it might seem like today it's pretty fuzzy and confusing, it was the same in Jesus' time. When Jesus did his ministry, there was confusion over what exactly was the Christian of that day. Who exactly is, and what do people mean by saying they are a follower of God? So today we're going to look at a section in Mark where Jesus comes and he gives clarity to exactly what it means to be a Christian. He gives a very sharp definition on what it means to be a follower of God. And it's my hope that we look at this and we get that clarity and we think about how we need to be absolutely clear when we have conversations with other people and we express that we are a Christian, what we mean by that, that we take it a bit further than just a label, that we push into, this is what I mean when I am saying that I am a Christian, and not leave it up to others to just make up whatever they think might be what a Christian is. So let's pray and ask God to help us see that today in Mark. Dear God, we thank you again for your word. Particularly, we thank you for Jesus, and thank you that he shows us exactly who you are and gives us great hope and confidence, a relationship with the eternal God. Thank you for that, Lord, and we ask by your Holy Spirit you'll help us to understand more of Mark and that you'll change us and guide us into the future. Amen. So we're looking at Mark chapter 2, and we started at verse 13. In that time, in that environment, it would be natural to say that there's two ways that you can respond to God. You could either reject God wholesale and have nothing to do with him, and just walk away, just turn your back on him, do as you see fit, as you please. That could be one way. Or there could be another way where you do obey God and you follow him and you live out all the things that you've been reading in the Bible. So it'd be easy to look at those two things and go, okay, there's two ways that you can respond to God. But when we look in this passage, we see that there's this group of people called the tax collectors. I did this in the 8:30 service, so pick me up. I keep saying tax collectors when I mean to say teachers of the law, okay? So verse 13, you'll see that there's this group called the tax collectors. I said it again straight away, didn't I? Verse 15, 16, that's why I'm getting confused. There's this group called the teachers of the law, who were Pharisees. And it would have been natural to see that this group here, the teachers of the law, are the people that respond to God, rightly. They do, you know, all the God stuff. And they would be contrasted with the other people around them, like the Greeks and the Romans and the tax collectors, who they don't seem to care much about God stuff. They do things their own way. So you've got the teachers of the law, and they do God stuff. And then you have everyone else who just do as they please. And this is the category that it would be easy to sort of break people into. So you could say that the teachers of the law and the Pharisees, this group of people who do the God stuff, we could describe them as religious, and everyone else could be described as irreligious. Those two categories. But as you read through Mark's story, we see that it's not quite as simple to say, well, the people who do the God stuff, the religious people, are right, and it's the people who don't do the God stuff and reject God, the irreligious people, who are actually rejecting God and responding badly. Mark's gospel, the way that he writes the story, he sets up a dynamic that shows us that there is actually another way than just being irreligious by which you can reject God. So have you noticed, as we've gone through the story of Mark, that there's this dynamic where you see just about in every story, Jesus teaches, he starts teaching, and along with that, he calls followers to himself, he calls disciples towards himself, and then there's this group called the teachers of the law and the Pharisees that emerge, and they start to get agitated with Jesus. Have you noticed that as we read through Mark? That dynamic is occurring in the stories that we read today. So if we pick it up at Verse 13, we see that again, Jesus is teaching. And then in verse 14, he calls someone to follow him. And then the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, this group emerge and they start to get agitated. We see in verse 16, they say, "Why does he eat with tax collectors and sinners?" And then in the next story, in verse 18, how is it that John's disciples and the disciples of the Pharisees are fasting, but yours are not? Or further down, in verse 24, the Pharisees said to Jesus, "Look, why are they doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath?" This same dynamic that's been going on throughout Mark is occurring again in this story, where you have the people, the religious people, doing the God stuff, being at odds with Jesus. This is how Jesus responds. Verse 17. Jesus says to them, "It is not the healthy who need a doctor, but the sick. I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners." So in the middle of this tension, Jesus puts up this contrast. And the contrast is between the healthy and the sick, and then the righteous and sinners. And they're in parallel, aren't they? We get the point that the healthy people are the righteous people, and the sick people are the sinners. The implication is that Jesus, with what he's doing, hanging out with these sinners, he's hanging out with the sick people. So he's pointing to himself as being the doctor amongst the sick people, ready to heal. So does that mean then that the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, this group that do God stuff, that they are righteous? That's a question mark that sort of comes forth at this point. Is that what Jesus is saying in the contrast? Are these guys righteous? That question hangs there, but it gets answered and clarified as we keep reading through Mark. So if you look at the last verse of what we read, which is chapter 3, verse 6, the end of this sequence of stories, Mark puts in the description that the Pharisees went out and began to plot with the Herodians how they might kill Jesus. At this point, this group that looked righteous, their real motives and their real status is betrayed, isn't it? You've got the people that do the God stuff, deep in their heart, ready to kill God's anointed king. The righteous people are ready to kill and plot murder. And the hypocrisy comes out again, showing that they're not as righteous as they make out to be, comes forward in the fact that who do they plot with? The Herodians, another group of people that they would have looked to and said, they're sinners. So they don't allow Jesus to be with a group of sinners, but they're happy to join with a group of sinners in order to kill Jesus. So after reading this detail and this kind of description of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law keeps popping up throughout Mark, we see that Jesus is being sarcastic and ironic at this point. He's saying that the Pharisees and the teachers of the law are people who view themselves as righteous. They are people who believe that they are not sinners. They contrast themselves. They do not fall short of God, and that they actually have righteousness that they can present to God and God would accept them. Jesus, with this little parable, is saying it's that very attitude that actually prevents them from having access to the doctor, to the guy that will heal. And we see that other descriptions throughout all the Gospels, and in fact are wider in the New Testament, and we can even look at other writings that were written at the same time as the New Testament, and even writings that the Pharisees, they themselves wrote. And that confirms that this group of people believed that they actually were righteous, that they had things of which they can offer God and he would have to accept them. That's their attitude. But it's that very attitude that prevents them from having access to the doctor. So we can say that there's actually two ways by which you can reject God. You can reject God by being irreligious. That is, you turn your back on everything that God has to say and you just go and do what you want, you live as you please. Or you can actually reject God by being religious. That is, you do obey God's rules and you do the God stuff, but you do it in such a way that you present it to God as though God owes you, that you are not a sinner. You actually have righteousness and worth before God, and God owes you as a result of that. And Jesus is saying here that the actual attitude and position that you need to adopt in order to be with God is one of a sinner, and recognize that you need healing from the doctor. And we've seen in the previous stories that the healing that the doctor gives is forgiveness of sins. So we can put this more neatly, that there's three ways that you can respond to God. And that is irreligion, which we've said, rejecting God wholesale, or actually obeying God in such a way that you present it to him that he has to accept you. Or you actually respond to God with the gospel view, that is that you are sick and you are a sinner and that you need the doctor to heal you. We have to be very clear when we talk about our faith, when we use the label Christian, that we are explaining exactly how we do respond to God. Because it's very easy, isn't it, to have Christianity, what we believe, the gospel, looking like religion. Because sometimes the God stuff in the religious mold looks exactly like what we would be doing as Christians. You think of that group, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law. They talked about the same God. They read the same Bible. They would even agree on the same sort of standard of what good living looks like, same group of morals. However, there is a fundamental difference in our response to God. The religious person says, I obey, therefore I am accepted. Where the person who understands the gospel says, I'm actually profoundly sick, I'm a sinner, and I need the healing of the doctor, and because I get that, therefore I will obey God. I will have gratitude towards him. We've got to be clear on that distinction. All religions and irreligion have this in common. They are ways of justifying yourself before God or a set of values, where the gospel is profoundly different when it recognizes that there's nothing in us that can justify us before God. We need to have that clarity when we're talking about our faith. What's really sad is that the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, the people who were doing the God stuff, that they didn't get this, that they didn't come up with this position that they were actually sinners. And the reason is because they read the Old Testament. The Old Testament, as you know, is a book that one of its big themes is showing that mankind, which God created, has turned their back on the Creator. And they deserve to be punished for that. They deserve death. No one is righteous before God. That is the big theme of the Old Testament. And as you read through, you see that no one ultimately gets that perfect relationship with God right. The Pharisees and the teachers of the law should have read the Old Testament and seen that even their people, the privileged people of Israel, continually failed to love God with all their heart, mind, and soul. They might do a few of the God things in such a way that they could tick boxes and then talk to God and say, well, therefore you're kind of trapped now, you have to bless me. They would do that, but they never loved God from the depth of their heart, mind, and soul. They had the sacrificial system, but they would work it in such a way that they would do sin and just go, well, we can patch it up later. When they sinned, they were never profoundly grieved that they had actually offended their God. And that's the whole big, one of the major themes of the Old Testament. That's why, at one level, it's quite a long book. It's showing unequivocally that these people cannot get into right relationship with God. They keep rejecting God, and they fail to love him with all their heart, mind, and soul. The Old Testament is an elaborate teaching aid to show us, humanity, the depth of our sin, just how sick we are. And that sickness, that sin we have, is a barrier to God, that God keeps his distance from sinners. That's the Old Testament. The Pharisees and the teachers of the law, this group, they had that and they were reading it, and yet they came to a different position. They thought that they were actually in right standing with God. That's what makes it so tragic to hear the response of the God people in Mark's story. Because it's such a tragic end to the Old Testament, that no one is righteous before God, and it repeats that over and over again, you get this other beautiful theme that emerges in the Old Testament where God says, right, I'm going to do a new thing. There's going to be a day where I will comprehensively forgive all people's sins, and I will change their heart and give them a new heart, so that now, for the first time, people will love God with all their heart, mind, and soul. And there's a whole section of the Old Testament called the Prophets that just repeats this theme over and over again. It becomes this great expectation that God is going to come and do a massive change, because humans cannot do it themselves. And some of the pictures and the images that keep popping up through the prophets are these. Flick them up on the screen. That on that day when God does this comprehensive work of forgiveness and he creates a new heart in people where they actually do love him with all their heart, mind, and soul, it will be such a joyous day that there will be feasting. All the pictures of greatness and fun and blessedness are used. A great day of feasting, there will be a wedding, there will be a wine, it will be a day of new things. This is such a pervasive theme right throughout the Old Testament. That's why I can sort of summarize it in the few minutes that I've done there without going all over the place on the Bible. It's there all through it, and the Pharisees and the teachers of the law